The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Monday, June 6th, 2016. My name is Michael Brooks, filling in for Sam Cedar on a Michael Brooks Monday on the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the Gowanus Canal in the heartland, from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, Milton Alamadi, the publisher of Black Star News, Ugandan journalist and human rights activist, is going to talk with us about local elections coming up in South Africa. Is there a challenge to the ANC? One from the neoliberal center-right, one from the populist radical left, but maybe not a good radical left. We'll get into that. What's happening to the ANC? What's happening in South Africa? Plus, a contested presidential election in Uganda and a history of horrific human rights violations under President Museveni, close African ally of the United States. We'll get into all of that with a bit of an Africa, partial Africa update with Milton Alamadi. Plus, tomorrow, California's voting. Bernie, within 2 points, according to a new CBS poll, all polls showing that race neck and neck as Bernie takes the progressive crusade to California. French protesters have been on the streets in their version of an Occupy movement, illustrating not only that they are protesting potentially tremendously damaging new labor laws, but really, once again, the failure of quote-unquote centrist politics in Europe. The Brexit vote is approaching. Soon we'll have a guest on it, but I'm going to comment on it today. And Donald Trump, kind of imploding to a degree. Getting a little messy out there on the field. And it's sad. Frankly, it's pathetic. And of course, speaking of the lowest of humanity, we saw the passing of the highest of humanity this past weekend with the greatest himself, Muhammad Ali, succumbing to poor health, really. He'd been obviously struggling with a number of conditions, but primarily Parkinson's, really for decades, actually. 70 years old. And American icon who did not transcend race. And anybody who says that doesn't know what they're talking about. We're going to reflect on him. Have a couple of pieces of sound that illustrate different parts of his incredible legacy. And actually, let's just start with one of them. Just really out of the gate. We'll talk about more about Muhammad Ali in the fun half. But do we have that iconic Muhammad Ali? You have the Viet Cong thing, right? I don't see it on the sound sheet. Okay, so this was, of course, you know, Muhammad Ali. We all know he joined the Nation of Islam in the mid 1960s. He changed his name to Muhammad Ali. He embraced Islam and black nationalism, and then when his ideals and his politics were put to the test, he refused to go and fight in Vietnam, and this was a decision that cost him his title. It put him in legal trouble until he was, you know, restored on appeal. But in the height of his career, with massive success and opportunity, he put it all on the line in every possible way, and he didn't evade it. He didn't, you know, get a cushy assignment. He just didn't go. And here's what he had to say about why he would not go to Vietnam to fight the Viet Cong.
My brother, some darker people, some poor hungry people in the mud for big powerful America, and shoot them for what? They never called me nigger. They never lynched me. They never put no dogs on me. They never robbed me of my nationality, raped and killed my mother and father. What, I'm going to shoot them for what? How can I go shoot them? Them little poor little black people, little babies and children and women. How can I shoot them poor people? I would just take me to jail.
True, I mean, that fusion of his charisma, his and just even watching him as a fighter. I mean, I respect boxing. My grandfather was actually a boxer, but you know, it's a brutal sport. But if you watch a montage of Muhammad Ali, there's a montage you can go. It's called Speed, Amazing Speed on YouTube. It's just unbelievable athleticism. And then you combine that with the politics. It's a singular guy, singular human being. And in that clip, you can also really hear that he totally transcended race. It was actually, you know what? It actually worked as a sound effect. So what are you going to do? Let's talk about, we'll get to Milton Alamadi at about 12:15, or in a couple of minutes, I should say, for those who are listening not live. And let's talk about one of today's sponsors, and that is ZipRecruiter. That's our sponsor today. With ZipRecruiter.com, you can post your job to up to 100 job sites, including social media networks like Facebook and Twitter, all with a single click. You know you have to be everywhere to find the best people. It goes without saying. Find candidates in any city or industry nationwide. Just post once and watch qualified candidates roll into ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use interface. No juggling emails or calls to your office. It's a simple, streamlined process. Quickly screen candidates, rate them, hire the right person fast. Find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by over 800,000 businesses. And right now, listeners can try ZipRecruiter for free by going to ZipRecruiter.com/majority. That's ZipRecruiter.com/majority. And one more time, you can try it for free today. This incredible service for finding the right candidate. Go to ZipRecruiter.com/majority. Now, I don't have my computer in front of me. Usually, is it you can pass me a note. We can go analog. Is it urgent? Oh, okay. Do you have sound ready?
Yeah.
Okay. So let's flow right into that. So I just wanted to say that, and obviously, you know, everybody knows how much Sam enjoys talking about this next sponsor. And I actually felt a little bit bad about doing it. Sam loves to make fun of them and then take their money. I'm going to streamline it a little bit and just take their money. And maybe make Sam upset, which isn't terrible either. And that's why I want to introduce you to today's sponsor, libertarianism.org. Libertarianism.org is the premier resource for learning about the theories, principles, and histories of free societies. The site has podcasts, videos, books, free books, classic reprints, and insights from experts past and present. Libertarianism are for those who are skeptical that there's only one way of doing things. I mean, why not err on the side of more freedom? Some respect for what makes us different. To learn more about free and open societies, visit libertarianism.org, one of today's sponsors. And to learn potentially even more about libertarianism, let's listen to some of this classic sound that Matt has queued up for us.
Well, let me just set the table a little bit because we haven't seen this sound before.
Set the table, please.
This is Gary Johnson, who won the nomination. It turns out that a lot of like Daryl Perry types in the libertarians, the more purist libertarians, aren't terribly happy with Gary Johnson or his VP pick.
Bill Weld.
Yeah.
Former governor of Massachusetts.
And so here's Gary Johnson hearing that from at the Libertarian Party conference.
So this is Gary Johnson, who is really like the establishment pick of the Libertarian wing.
The Kasich
of the Libertarian Party. Fund will probably get some sort of corporate money behind him at some point. Bill Weld, very establishment Massachusetts governor, actually a very big no-no in this world, even though he apologized and recanted for it. He endorsed Barack Obama in 2008 and has supported gun control at certain points. So these people are, they're almost as mad as Bernie supporters, except they're completely insane and irrational to begin with. So Let's listen to Gary Johnson.
My question. Governor Johnson, in 2008, your vice presidential pick endorsed Barack Obama. In 2012, he didn't endorse Ron Paul. He didn't endorse you. He endorsed Mitt Romney. In 2016, he endorsed John Kasich. Why didn't your VP pick endorse you?
First of all, beyond my wildest dreams, I asked Bill Weld to join me. We realized that we're running separately. But he's the original libertarian.
What?
So basically, Gary Johnson is in 2012, he was flying under the radar. The Libertarian Party was essentially an irrelevancy. It would get about maybe 1% of the national vote. And he could kind of slide in there and go around and pretend that he opposed the drone program and say vague things about pot when really all he was doing was pushing a Koch brothers agenda. But now that the heat is on them, their purists want to be pure. And so he and Bill Weld, they think that they're going to have a great splash and cut into Donald Trump and cut into Hillary Clinton and reveal the truth of the doctrine for the whole country. But in reality, they're going to be harassed by to borrow from another political slur applied to Howard Dean supporters. But in this case, it's actual reality. They're going to be followed around by the bar scene in Star Wars of politics and harassed about every sane, decent, and non-demented thing they have ever done, because that's what those people don't like, besides the pot part. And they have a lot to look forward to over the next couple of months, as do we. When it comes to magazines, you know what you like. And with Texture, you can get all the magazines you want in one super convenient place. The Texture app lets you tap into the world's most popular magazines anytime, anywhere, using your smartphone or tablet. Breeze through hundreds of your favorite magazines, including back issues, and pick up articles that interest you most. Texture has made it easy to find articles you care about. I don't just get to read all of my favorite magazines on tablet, like Rolling Stone, Mother Jones. I read Adweek when I do Two Dope Boys. I read, maybe even read Maclean's, read New York Magazine, all of these great magazines on tablet. The Texture editorial team recommends content for you every day so I can have a deeper dive with personalized collections beyond the authors and magazines that I'm already reading with my Texture subscription. The best part of Texture that we're offering our listeners is a free trial right now. When you get to texture.com/majority, you'll immediately gain entry to all the top magazines, including back issues and bonus video content. Start binge reading for free right now when you go to texture.com/majority. That's texture.com/majority. Start binge reading the best magazines in the world now at texture.com/majority. We'll be right back with Milton Alamani.
Enough of them a flip up. All of them a fi run when King Selassie broke his seven seal and get up. East, look how my dread. Terrible, wall all your head. Government run under bed. When you see the Rasta coming in my coming.
This is the Majority Report. I'm Michael Brooks. Joining us now is Milton Alamati. He is the publisher of Black Star News and a prominent African journalist and analyst based in New York City. Milton, how are you doing?
Hey, man. How are you? Thank you for having me again on your show.
I'm doing well. It's great to be talking with you. We're going to get to South Africa and the situation in Uganda and get your insights on both of those situations in the kind of broader regional context. But before we do that, I noticed actually, because you and I are, well, we're friends on the podcast, we're friends in real actual life, and we're friends in Facebook. And I saw post a picture of you and Muhammad Ali on your timeline. So I know that, you know, a lot of us are obviously feeling the results of such a kind of, you know, it's fair to say, really singular human being pass away. But you actually got to spend some time with him. So what are your reflections on the greatest? I just want to get your thoughts.
Well, hey, man, you know what? The most impressive thing, and I think that's why you're seeing this outpouring from all over the world, is because this was a man who was really respected and beloved beyond boxing.
Yes.
I think that's where he really, really created his legacy, beyond boxing. We're familiar with famous, great athletes, even in his own arena. And, you know, Joe Frazier was a great boxer.
Absolutely.
Foreman is a great boxer. Marciano is a great boxer. Tyson's a great boxer. But this is a person that really made his reputation beyond boxing with the stance he took, right? Principal stance when he refused to be drafted to go to Vietnam. And even toward the latter stages of his life, when his health was declining, he still made the effort to contribute to charities, to travel around the world, even with declining health. This shows that he was really dedicated, and all along, he wasn't doing it for the money. He did it because he really believed in what he was doing, and that's what I really respected him about the most.
Yeah, you know, I just want to underline that, too, and pivot off of this. In the intro to today, we played that, you know, the famous clip of him explaining why he wouldn't go fight the Viet Cong. And, you know, why would he go fight the Viet Cong? They never hung him. They never destroyed his family. They never called him slurs. Now, there's a really important distinction, I think, that you just raised there, because now we see some people are very into this kind of like Muhammad Ali transcended race thing. And it's fascinating because there's such a basic distinction. There's one thing that you can, in your particular of who you are, be a totally globally connected, globally inspired, and sort of iconic person across all boundaries and speak to everybody. That doesn't mean that you have dissociated from your identity and you don't speak specifically from your identity. So I just wanted to kind of get you to speak on that a little bit as well, and then we'll move to South Africa.
I think it's critical, actually. And, you know, I go back to Malcolm X, because Malcolm was, in fact, the person that helped really raise Ali's consciousness and enlighten him and recruited him to the Nation.
Right.
Even though they later, I don't want to say really had a falling out, but Ali started avoiding him after Malcolm left the Nation.
Right.
And Ali continued to support Elijah Muhammad. But nevertheless, it was Ali who really, Malcolm, who really raised his consciousness. And one thing Malcolm said that I fully believe in, he said, you know what? White people actually respect you more if you speak truth to power.
Hmm.
If you really tell them how you feel about the conditions, instead of being quiet and not speaking out against injustice and hoping that that's the best way to befriend or have white friends. So those aren't really your friends. Your friends are the ones that you speak truth to power, and if they still like you, then indeed they're your friends. And even if they don't like you, they respect you.
Mm.
And I fully believe that. That's in his speech. I think it's in the ballot or the bullet. It's in that speech, or at least in one of his speeches. And I think Ali actually took that. He took that advice, and that's how he lived his life. And that's why you're seeing the outpouring today.
Absolutely. I really wanted to get your thoughts on that. Now, let's move to South Africa.
Yes.
There's two parts of this, and let's work it backwards a little bit. There's local elections, mm-hmm. Which have been scheduled in May, about a week ago, that are going to take place on August 3rd. And this is an opportunity, obviously, particularly in the Cape Province, which is actually run by the Democratic Alliance. So that's a sort of, just to kind of lay the table here, you have the African National Congress, the Party of Liberation, that's been governing South Africa since 1994. Then you have the Democratic Alliance, that's sort of a, the merging of sort of, it's a white party. But it's also a very neoliberal, very market-oriented party, and it's run actually by a young, charismatic black politician, Musa Maimane. And then you have the Economic Freedom Fighters, who are run by a guy named Julius Malema, and we'll get to all of them later and where they all sort of fit, but just to kind of set the stage. But before we get there, I mean, can you kind of take us through what has been happening with Jacob Zuma recently and the kind of unraveling to some degree of the present ANC government? Because obviously there's always been problems and controversies under, even under Mandela, certainly under Mbeki, but it seems like under Zuma we're going to a different place in terms of problems inside the ANC.
Right. I think Zuma has not been able to curb his lack of discipline. Is that the best way to put it? Which actually he's exemplified throughout his career.
Mm-hmm.
Many people are actually surprised that he ever ended up becoming president of South Africa. But that also speaks to his capability to organize support at the grassroots level.
Right.
A few people thought he would survive the arms scandal, you know, the alleged kickbacks from arms imports that he was involved in.
This is going back to 1990s. Would you actually explain
we're going way,
that?
Way back.
Yeah, would you explain that to people a bit so they have an understanding?
Yeah, that's before he was being
way before
president.
He was president, right?
Right, and he played a role in the importation of arms to the country for the army. But allegedly, he was involved in taking kickbacks. And then, as you know, he also had the trial when he was accused of raping the daughter of a friend.
Yes.
And he made that preposterous statement that he even though she was HIV positive, he made sure he took a shower.
Well, that was, right. That was when he basically, the defense was his claim that they had had consensual sex, and he admitted to being not using a condom, even though he knew that she was HIV positive, and he said he took a shower.
And consensual, but he said that he's in his tradition, if a woman was appeared to be ready to have sex and he did not, it would have been like as if he was insulting her. It was really ridiculous. But he got acquitted of that as well.
Right.
And many other scandals.
And we had on on Ronnie Castrols recently. He talked about how going back to like his experience with Zuma from the 70s, he was always very disturbed by Zuma's misogyny. So that's a very big arc in his career. But yeah, but anyways, go ahead.
And he's not been able to separate that from his politics. And then, of course, you have the recent case of his spending in excess of, I think it was almost $20 million at that time. I think it's the exchange rate has changed now, so it's more about $15 to $16 million perhaps. But nevertheless, he spent that allegedly to make security upgrades on his personal residence. And the security upgrades included like swimming pool, and a chicken coop and stuff that has
and
nothing,
an amphitheater,
no
an amphitheater, yeah.
Right.
I feel more secure at swimming pools around me, though. To be fair.
What happened?
I'm just kidding. I said I feel more secure with swimming pools around me as well.
Well, you know what? People are joking that maybe he thought because he really believes South Africans can't swim, and maybe would be in treated would drown in the swimming pool.
Okay.
Those are kind of jokes going around. It's crazy. And then he refused to, when confronted, he refused to pay. But then recently, the Constitutional Court said he, in fact, violated the Constitution and it's been ordered to pay.
Right.
And people thought that was very humbling, and there was they started making demands that perhaps he should resign or step down. But you know, he has the ANC has an overwhelming parliamentary majority, so that's why he was able to survive the attempt to impeach him. But going forward, I think he's really damaged significantly the ANC brand, and the upcoming municipal and mayoral elections throughout the country I think that could be a strong statement, because in the last one, 5 years ago, I think the ANC won 62%, which was about a 5 points drop from from the one prior to that, from 5 years before that. And the Democratic Alliance, I think they got an additional 10 points or so. So they went from 14% to 24%. And given the kind of news that Zuma has been generating on behalf of the ANC, the alliance could actually gain additional 10-plus points. And this time we have a new player. You mentioned the Economic Freedom Party. This is the first time they'll be participating in these
before we get to that, Milton, I want to, because I think this actually leads into understanding those parties. Let's go back a little bit to Jacob Zuma and the internal situation in the ANC, because, you know, this is obviously still the overwhelming power in South Africa, and in many ways, rightfully so. And so, you know, this is the historical party of liberation. It's the party of Nelson Mandela. And then, to give a bit, even a bit more context, Jacob Zuma was the deputy president under Mandela's successor, Thabo Mbeki. Thabo Mbeki moved against Zuma, got rid of Zuma as a result of, primarily actually, of the corruption allegations. And then at the same time, there was the rape allegation against Zuma. Right. Zuma actually was able to maneuver a sort of populist rage against Mbeki, who is perceived as kind of elitist. Intellectual, elitist, all of that. I would actually add, I think, did have some genuinely very problematic positions on AIDS, but that's a kind of conversation for a different day. But Zuma was able to engineer and take back over the ANC. And in many ways, actually, by being very politically savvy in terms of kind of indicating to, like, he would go to the, you know, global institutions and say, I'm going to follow traditional neoliberal macroeconomic policies like Mbeki, but then going to the communist and the trade union allies and really indicating, well, wait a second, we're not doing enough for the poor, we're not populist enough. He actually was very skillful at sort of showing everybody what they wanted to see. And so the theory is, in some ways, that And this is where I want you to explain this, and then maybe you can get back into describing the other parties. Because what's so odd about the ANC now is it seems like this is a, you know, again, we keep saying it's a historically very vibrant, it's the party of liberation. It's also a party of a lot of discipline, but a lot of intellectual diversity and consensus decision making. And it also seems like we have really different tracks inside the ANC. There's kind of a core around Zuma that does seem pretty corrupt and kleptocratic, and that's a problem in the ANC. And then you have the kind of some people in the sort of Mbeki sort of technocratic kind of macroeconomic center right kind of wing. And then you still have like people of the left who want the next liberation of South Africa, which involves economic justice. So I guess my question is how is Zuma still keeping that all together, even as he's kind of getting really battered? And as you kind of point out, rightfully so. And then how do those kind of splits and contradictions lead to understanding where the DA is now and the economic freedom fighters?
In fact, I think you've actually pretty much laid it out and answered the question. I was simply going to say, I don't think this kind of coalition can be maintained any longer. I think it was important to have charismatic and very respected individuals like Nelson Mandela, of course, and then to an extent Thabo Mbeki as well. I think Zuma has managed to unravel that. In the run-up to these municipal and mayoral elections, when people were recruiting new voters, the ANC folks were actually wearing T-shirts that did not bear, for the first time, Jacob Zuma's image, whereas the other parties had images of their party leaders, of course. So that tells you that the ANC is well aware of the jeopardy that Zuma has put the party in. I think that's why increasingly the more left-leaning party, and I think if Malema was not considered as a bit erratic, I think he would actually be able to broaden a lot more than he has already. Mm. I think there are
that's
people
the
that
leader of the
outlets.
Economic freedom fighters, Julius
Absolutely.
Malema. Okay,
right, right. The one whose supporters wear the red beret in their rallies and in parliament as well. And I think the other folks that are going to drift away from the ANC would tend to go to the Democratic Alliance. The 600,000 new voters that have been registered for the upcoming mayoral and municipal elections, almost 80% are below the age of 30. They're either 30 or younger than 30. Mm-hmm. And these are folks that will not have that same kind of connect or memory of the liberation struggle and the great sacrifice and contribution that the ANC actually made in waging that liberation war. I think to them, they're going to be looking more at the issues of which party is going to be more effective in fighting corruption, which party is going to be more effective in delivering services, particularly in the urban areas, you know, transport, housing, education, the basic bread and butter kind of services that are expected from municipalities and from mayors. And I think that's going to dent the ANC's capabilities. And depending on how significant it is in terms of the numbers, that could also eventually translate into the national elections. So the ANC is quite aware and very conscious of it. And that's why they're not really associating with any image that is related to Jacob Zuma right now.
So do you think that means that there's going to be another leadership upheaval in the ANC, or does it mean that?
Well, he can't. He's basically finished his second term.
Right.
Had it been, if this was his first term and things are already as a factor as it is right now, I imagine he might not have been able to serve a second term. So luckily for him, he's actually served. He's finishing his second term already. So the transition is not going to be as fractious as it was when he maneuvered Thabo Mbeki out of office.
So yeah, the last question I have about the ANC specifically, though, is that so even if Zuma's sort of wrapping things up, and you know, who knows, I mean, what kind of immunity deals he might want, and you know, all the sort of things that he's going to have to maneuver in terms of just his own personal interest. But the deputy president now is Cyril Ramaphosa, who's another, you know, again, of the younger generation, like the Mbeki Zuma generation. That's a relative term, but not as old as Mandela or Kathrada or, you know, folks like that.
Right.
So he's another kind of...
I don't think he's a top contender.
Okay, he's not.
Because
I was going to say
that... Because of his association with capital, finance capital. He's a very, very extremely wealthy man.
Right.
And in South Africa... that is something really hard to sell right now, given the high level of unemployment, particularly youth unemployment, which I think some stats say as high as between 40 to 50%. And then, of course, he was associated with the hard retribution towards the strikers when they had the mining dispute. So I think he's actually, I don't see him as a leading contender. Ironically, Madame Zuma, his former wife, who is now the leader of the African Union in Addis Ababa, is widely reported as being a major contender. So don't be surprised that if she actually ends up being the party leader and the next president of South Africa.
And this is Jacob Zuma's ex-wife, and really no longer, they're not sort of political partners, so it actually really would be like same name, but potentially radically different leadership. That's fascinating.
Absolutely, absolutely. In fact, before she went to the African Union, she was one of the most respected South African politicians in terms of fighting corruption and in terms of delivering services in which ministry that she served in.
And by divorcing her husband, who apparently is kind of a mess, but a brilliant tactician. She and her performance at the African Union apparently has been really impressive as well. So that's fascinating. Let's
elevated the level of the African Union, its visibility to the extent that when President Obama was in the continent last year. He actually, for the first time, a U.S. president addressed the African Union gathering with all the leaders in attendance.
So let's move to Uganda, which I know is obviously quite
country.
Well, you have a bias. but before we there's a crisis there now, but I think that this is a place that I think the American understanding of Uganda is basically that Idi Amin was a really bad guy, and that's
right.
So we have another actually pretty bad guy governing Uganda now, and often with U.S. support. So lead us up to the present crisis, though, by explaining who President Museveni is, how he came to power.
Right. President Museveni was actually one of the Ugandans who were educated in Tanzania. Mm-hmm. After Idi Amin came to power, I think he was perhaps in his 20s then. And like many of us Ugandans, our families fled Uganda because he had worked in the president of that time was Milton Obote. He'd worked in one of his government agencies. I think, in the intelligence services, I believe. So he went on to complete his education in Tanzania. He was identified with left politics, progressive politics. And then after Idi Amin was defeated in 1979, came back to Uganda. He formed a political party. He was part of the young folks that actually joined together with Tanzanian soldiers to fight against Idi Amin after Amin had, had invaded Tanzania in 1978. The counterattack led to the destruction of Amin's army in 1979, and he fled Uganda. Then there was a transitional government. Museveni was in that transitional government as the transitional minister of defense. He managed to sign up a lot of troops into what then later on obviously became his personal army or militia.
So he has a militia separate from the Ugandan army. He has his own kind of paramilitary?
Oh, he did at that time, even before the 1980 elections, because he was the transitional minister of defense.
Okay.
So even though he was nominally recruiting soldiers for the new Ugandan army post Idi Amin, he made sure that most of them were actually loyal to him.
Okay.
And then there were elections in 1980, and the elections were disputed. The Uganda People's Congress of Milton Obote was declared the winner, and Obote came back into office. My own father was actually a close colleague of Obote and grew up together, and he, my father became foreign minister in that government. The party that claimed that it had actually won was the Democratic Party, which claimed it was denied victory and it had actually beat the UPC. Museveni's party performed the worst. I think he himself was not elected to parliament. He got, I think, two seats in parliament. And he is actually the one, not the Democratic Party, but it was he, Museveni, who went into the bush, so to speak, and launched an insurgency. That war was pretty bloody, particularly in one part of Uganda called Luwero, where atrocities were committed, reportedly by the army as well as by Museveni's guerrillas. In 1985, before scheduled elections, the army overthrew Obote. The army had gotten tired of this war, and they signed a deal with Museveni, power sharing. But then about 6 months later, Museveni overthrew the leaders of the junta that had overthrown Obote, and he himself installed himself as president. That was in 1986, and he's been president of Uganda since then. There have been four elections, the last four elections, that he has managed to successfully rig and to continue as ruler of Uganda. The last one was the most blatant one.
Mm.
Now, in all these elections, the U.S. has pretty much been quiet because he's been very effective in serving U.S. interests in the region.
Could you explain that a little bit more?
Okay. In the 1990s, for example, Museveni convinced the U.S. that the French influence in Rwanda and Burundi could be displaced with an Anglo-U.S. Influence.
Mm-hmm.
And the U.S. sort of turned a blind eye when Uganda invaded Rwanda in October 1990. And most of the soldiers were actually members of the Ugandan army. And many of them were the offspring of Tutsi who had fled from Rwanda in the 1960s when the majority Hutu had a revolution and overthrew a Tutsi monarchy. So their offspring were people like Paul Kagame, actually.
Mm-hmm. So who's the president of Uganda,
who's president of Rwanda today, right?
Mm-hmm.
They invaded in 1990. And the war went on till the year 94. Then there was sort of a stalemate. And then they signed a peace deal, the RPF, the Rwanda Patriotic Front, which was the name of the new invading army now. So they signed a deal with the government of Juvenal Habyarimana in Tanzania. But then the plane was carrying the president of Rwanda, Habyarimana, and the president of Burundi was shot down. And they were both of them killed, of course. And then that's when the ugly massacres.
This is what precipitated the sort of the Rwandan genocide. So the point is that he has played this sort of, and very intentionally, very strategically, but he's played in his region in Africa, in his sort of neighborhood, kind of warlord politics, and very opportunistically exploited very unstable places and used the weight of Uganda to advance, you know, not even narrow national interests, probably literally narrow personal interests in some respects, under the umbrella and the cosign of the United States, because of the umbrella of things like we need to be Anglophile instead of Francophile. I think
exactly.
More recently it was under the kind of war on terrorism rubric as well, right?
Yes, absolutely. That came
okay.
later.
Okay.
The first after this, then of course from Rwanda, they had access to the huge prize, which was actually Congo
right.
and its resources in eastern Congo.
Right.
And then I think that's the where Q, the U.S. Yeah. Policy was also actually eyeing and supporting. And so many companies actually have been able to extract resources illegally through the Congo, from the Congo, using that whole corridor opened up by Museveni and Kagame. So from Uganda to Rwanda, you now have access to Congo. That was the first major story. In more recent years, he's sort of aligned himself with the U.S. as a co-warrior in the fight against global Islamic terror. So he stationed about 10,000 Ugandan soldiers in Somalia to fight Al-Shabaab, which is affiliated with Al-Qaeda. And for that, the U.S. Has pretty much turned a blind eye to whatever else he's been doing in Uganda in terms of the human rights abuse. Now, the recent election was so blatantly rigged and so clearly won by the opposition Forum for Democratic Change, led by Kizza Besigye, that even the U.S. could not pretend that it was not that bad.
Mm-hmm.
So the U.S. actually issued a statement effectively saying these elections were not free, fair, or credible. And the U.S. ambassador in Uganda then went on to make a speech in Uganda saying from now on, the U.S. will work directly with Ugandan institutions and organizations and avoid official channels such as ministries, not only because of the rigged election, but also because of the corruption and embezzlement of resources, including money that was meant to fight tuberculosis and HIV/AIDS.
Milton,
so that
just to pause for 1 minute, because I want to get this one specific question, because that's a radical step from the perspective of U.S. policy, where Museveni has certainly been part of the club. And I think it was fascinating because I think obviously with the warlord politics in places like the Congo, it's not like, you know, we weren't naive. We knew exactly what he was doing and our interests benefited from it and all of the humanitarian consequences. So and ignoring all of the previous rigged elections. So with that in mind, it's a two-part question. One was, what made it so much more apparent that this election was even more egregiously rigged? Is that the rise of social media in Uganda? And then two, is his opposition also going to be harmonious with U.S. interests, so we feel more comfortable potentially pivoting from Museveni.
You know, I laugh because you actually you asked questions that the issue that I wanted to address.
Okay.
And let me address the second part first.
Okay.
Yes, the opposition has been making statements clearly that this army that is stationed in Somalia is not Museveni's personal army. So there's no reason why a policy in which Uganda would be involved in trying to stabilize Somalia would not continue. But then the opposition is saying, in addition to that, other African countries should actually join in that operation. And Somali civil society and politicians should also become a part of it.
Right.
But the number one thing they're saying is that they're not going to just come in and over and withdraw Uganda's forces. So I think that has been very significant in terms of reassuring the U.S., and that's making a difference. And then in terms of how clear was it that this election was egregiously, blatantly rigged, well, Museveni actually invited the European Union to observe the elections, as well as the Commonwealth. The Commonwealth is a collection of former British colonies, as well as the U.K. itself. And they had observed past elections in Uganda. But this is the first time that both the EU and the Commonwealth were invited. And they had many observers deployed throughout the country. So they were able to document it. And the EU, I think obviously the EU was not going to doctor or massage or say that, you know, this election was credible, even on behalf of the U.S., right?
Right.
So when the EU made its preliminary report before the official results were announced by Museveni's hand-picked election commission, the EU said these elections were not credible. He said that they said the state was fused together with Museveni, so it wasn't clear whether the opposition was running against candidate Museveni or the Ugandan state with all its resources. There was an article in Newsweek that Museveni spent, I think, $10 million on his campaign of state resources. The combined opposition spent less than $900,000. So when the EU made that statement before Museveni's rigged results were announced by his hand-picked electoral commission, I think it became difficult for the U.S. To say otherwise, for the U.S. to come out and say, no, the EU is actually lying. And then the Commonwealth pretty much came out and made a very similar statement as well. And then it was the hours later that Museveni's election commission came out and said he was the official winner of the election.
I see. So Milton, before we wrap up, I mean, this is the sort of part of the conversation where we have the open-ended kind of what comes next, what needs to happen question. And I ask that obviously because of you're from Uganda, you're a keen observer of the situation, but I think in some respects you're also very much a participant in
Absolutely. The
change that needs to happen and an advocate in Uganda.
Yes.
So what do you see happening and what needs to happen from the perspective of U.S. foreign policy or EU foreign policy? What can be done here to get the country out of the hands of Museveni and his family?
Well, I think obviously he needs to go. Now the question is, how will he go? I don't think he will be able to complete another five-year term. The youth are really outraged and showing it so on social media. If you see the social media postings, and not surprisingly, because unemployment, youth unemployment is calculated at 83% mm-hmm. in Uganda, the highest in the African continent. So I don't think he'll be able to sustain his government for another 5 years. And even the army is now split. The military is allowed to vote. And in the garrisons where the votes were documented before the polling was shut down, or rather the announcement of the results was shut down, in all the garrisons that the military's vote was documented, they actually voted for the opposition. So now he can't even trust his own army to sustain it for the next 5 years. It would be better, of course, if he were to leave the country. I don't know under what circumstances or where he would go.
Saudi Arabia, maybe? That's where they all go. That's where everybody goes. Let's go hang out in Saudi Arabia.
I think one of the other things that he's doing is that he's hoping that he can get like a different audience with the next U.S. administration. I think he had a personal relationship with the Clintons, so maybe he believes they would be much more sympathetic. But I don't think the U.S., no matter how sympathetic they would like to be to Museveni, would be able to change the narrative of the ground right now. The narrative of the ground is for Museveni to be out. The opposition leader, Kizza Besigye, who was arrested even during the election itself, is now detained. He's been charged with treason because he actually swore himself in as president the day before Museveni's own swearing in, which was also interesting because the U.S. delegation and the U.S. ambassador walked out of Museveni's swearing in because Omar Bashir, the president of the Sudan, was there. And then Museveni also slammed the International Criminal Court, said it's a bunch of useless people. That's at what point that the U.S. actually walked out. So I think the U.S. is sending enough signals that it would be willing to side with Ugandans this time, and that after 30 years, Museveni's regime must come to an end in Uganda. The possibility of that happening is much more higher now. When will it happen? In the next couple of months or the next years? I would tend to think more the next several months rather than years. But I don't see him completing another five-year cycle in Uganda. And I think if once he's gone, there's a good chance of more stability in the entire region, East and Central Africa. And then these countries that have been negotiating for years to move toward a common market with free movement of peoples and trades and resources, I think that can actually be realized post-Museveni's Uganda.
Yeah, he really is. He's really something of a cancer in that zone, as I've learned from actually following you. And after, hopefully, this happens in a speedy and nonviolent and efficient manner, and then let's fly to Uganda together and get you elected to parliament.
Let's build the Black Star first into global media.
Okay, that sounds good.
We'll discuss that.
Okay, that's second on the list. Okay, thank you, Milton Alamadi. Always a great pleasure to talk to you. Publisher of Black Star
News. Anytime. Thank you.
All right, be well. Bye-bye. Okay, everybody. Love talking to Milton. We're going to get to the fun half. We got a lot of sound. We've got more Muhammad Ali sound. We've got Bernie in L.A. We've got Donald Trump getting caught in a lie. Wow. He takes lying to a transcendent place. You know, I was talking with somebody over this past weekend about how, you know, what makes the kind of mental illness that Donald Trump has different from, you know, like Richard Nixon was, you know, a sociopath, straight up. I mean, if you read transcripts or listen in slow motion, as Matt does, to Nixon tapes, you know, him and Kissinger talking about bombing Laos and Cambodia and bombing dikes and knowing that they're flooding villages. I mean, that's pretty, you know, frankly, I will say everything on earth you could say about George W. Bush. I really doubt there's tapes of him saying like, yeah, whatever. You know, like that's a LBJ, amazing domestically, but kind of a criminal sociopath in Vietnam. Obviously, George W. Bush, you know, and all U.S. presidents actually when measured through that, you know, rubric. But the difference, but LBJ and Nixon are more on that continuum. But the difference is, and Matt and I were talking about this when I got in because I was remembering this conversation, is that, first of all, LBJ and Nixon are a lot smarter than Trump. And secondly, they both had guilt and self-doubt, which are not great qualities. But I guess if you're going to be like this sort of like overabundantly bloated orange narcissist, it's not a bad idea to have a little bit of it.
Yeah, a little bit of insecurity when you're the most powerful person on earth isn't maybe the worst thing.
Like Nixon opened China. And Trump would maybe have a similar idea, although not as strategic. And then someone would be like, you know, some state newspaper in China called him an imperialist. He'd be like, forget it. Cancel it. We're not going. I mean, there is something kind of unique there. So anyways.
Can you imagine Trump meeting Mao?
Yeah. Look, great guy. What he did with the Cultural Revolution, I mean, boy. Major work. I actually think, from what I've read of Mao, Mao would basically be insulting him the whole time, and Trump would completely not understand what was happening. The thing I would say about when you read Kissinger and Nixon, they're on that continuum of like highly damaged, brilliant, disturbed, megalomaniac people. So they kind of understood that Mao was messing with them. I think Trump would just be like, no idea that guy loved my casinos. He was in the mountains in China fighting, and he was thinking about the Trump Tower. It was incredible. Become a member of the Majority Report today, majority.fm/become a member. Go to Majority Report Kickback. That's where you can use our Amazon link, our Jet link. There's, yeah. Thank you. I'm on it. You can also, JustCoffee.coop, Fairtrade Tree Coffee and Chocolate, two dope boys. We've got more reviews coming in. We've got more shares. We just interviewed last week Matt FX, who's the music supervisor of Broad City and a really talented DJ. We have an incredible conversation on what is the creative life. Before that, we talked with this futurist Piers Fox on the Nomad class and the economics of a post-job economy. Feedback has been great. If you haven't subscribed yet, go to iTunes, two Dope Boys and a Podcast. Subscribe. We're also now on Stitcher and everywhere else. So wherever fine podcasts are subscribed to. And we talked about Somalia earlier briefly in the conversation with Milton Alamadi, and that made me think of Sam because Sam isn't here today, and I feel bad because he doesn't get to do an ad for his favorite sponsor we have. He loves to take money from this sponsor and then make fun of them. So let's just take money from them, and I will read today's post roll. And I want, in that spirit, to thank again our sponsor, libertarianism.org. Libertarianism.org has hundreds of informative resources to learn about the theories, history, and principles of free society. There are podcasts, videos, free books, classic reprints, and insights from experts, past and present. Learn more about free and open societies at libertarianism.org, and then send us your feedback and send them your feedback. All right, everybody, we will see you in the fun half. Non-members, peace, love, Shabbat Shalom.